It's not liberal. It's not conservative. It's progressive. The truth that empowers. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting live through our studios, New York City. I'm on the road now, doing some additional filming for a major new feature documentary that'll premiere in about the next 2 months. Today, I'm going to share the top healthiest seeds anywhere. And so I'm going to suggest that there's a lot of information to give, so you want to either put it on your computer or notepad, but this will hopefully motivate you to start having more seeds in your diet. Also, a study showed that cinnamon is good for your brain, and really good for the brain. We knew it was good for your blood sugar, but didn't know about the brain. And this was published in the Journal of Neuroimmunology and Pharmacology. Also today, we're going to do an in-depth, original investigative report white paper called The Injection Deception, Deconstructing the Science of Vaccine Efficacy. This is by our scholars and residents, Richard Gale, Jeremy Stillman, and myself. So it'll be posted today on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and Gary Noel, my Facebook, so you can read it and download it. Now, what's important is because we're really looking at all the science, objective science, and we're simply looking to show, are there any quality studies that prove that a single or combination of vaccines will protect you, guarantee to protect you, from the antigen, the virus that you're exposed to? Chickenpox, smallpox, whatever it may be. And I've included more than 59 outstanding references. So it's not just an opinion. This is from good science. So you won't want to miss this. And share it with others, please. Also today, we now know there is no longer, it's not a conspiracy theory. WikiLeaks released 20,000 emails showing that the Democratic National Committee conspired with Clinton to swing everything in the way of Clinton and away from Bernie Sanders. Now, that we suspected, and it was rather obvious for anyone who was watching how Clinton would have a small rally, Sanders would have a huge rally, no media attention at all to Sanders. Sanders was getting more of the popular vote, and there was vote irregularities in California and New York and other places. That should have brought lawsuits by Sanders. But most importantly today, this will tell you what Sanders is really about. Knowing now that his campaign was thwarted, undermined, illegally, unethically, by Clinton and the Democrats, will he then run as an independent? Will he challenge all this, all these misdeeds? Or will he simply say, well, it's time we all unified and got together? That'll tell you who he really is. So let's see what the outcome is. And then you'll understand why Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, though they're different on a lot of issues, both would be light years better than either the two front runners. Also today, people stopping on the beach. You had to be a registered Democrat, and they were asked a question about Hillary Clinton's vice president running mate, and this should surprise you. I'm going to play it. Also, someone recently said, well, you don't really believe that the CIA and all these mind control experiments, that's all conspiracy theory. That's nonsense. Is it? Well, I'm going to play you something today from NBC, October 11th, 1977. One of the most respected journalists in America, John Chancellor. And then you tell me that it's all nonsense. Also, more on the 28 pages that confirm that Saudi Arabia was part of the planning and financing of 9/11. And now there's a massive public relations program paid for by the Saudi government with dozens of PR firms and other front groups trying to say, oh, it proves nothing. Yes, it does. Also, it was 3 years ago, October 18th, 2013, at a National Center for Immunization Research and Surveillance study, a professor, Peter McIntyre, talked about the need for really looking at a good study on vaccines. Well, there has been none since. What happened in 3 years? And also, the first ever study finds toxic chemicals in the bodies of residents near fracking sites, and it's not good. So we should close down these fracking sites, and we should not allow any more. So as you see, we have a lot to share. We always begin on health and healing. And yesterday when I left the city on this current trip that I'm on, I always travel with a little food bag. And in the food bag, I had a series of seeds, about 9 different types of seeds. And I'll chew those throughout the day. And I had a long trip, so I knew I wouldn't be able to find a restaurant, and I wouldn't be able to make anything. So it served me fine. It can serve you fine as well. Here are the seeds that you should be consuming on a regular basis for their health and healing. My top seed would not be hemp. It would be chia, C-H-I-A. Just 1 teaspoon of chia seeds has 2.5 times the protein of kidney beans, 3 times more antioxidants than blueberries, 3 times more iron than spinach, 6 times more calcium than milk, 7 times more vitamin C than oranges, 8 times more omega-3 than salmon, 10 times more fiber than rice, and 15 times more magnesium than broccoli. So it quite simply is one of the most powerful, gluten-free, all-around healing seeds that you can put in your body. And it's rich in alpha-linolenic acid, a type of short-chain omega-3 fatty acid, whereas fish is a source of the long-chain fatty acids, the EPA and DHA. And most of the research now shows that the ALA, the alpha-linolenic acid, is better for you. And I want to thank the Natural Blaze for doing some of the computations. Now we have the hemp seed. And I believe that hemp is one of the most important plants to grow because it holds a lot of water and provides a lot of oxygen, but also because you can make some of the finest ropes and clothing materials and building materials from hemp. But nutritionally, you get all the essential fatty acids. It's a complete protein. It is very good at detoxifying the body. It seems to chelate out heavy metals. It's a good source of the essential fatty acids. It has a 3-to-1 ratio of omega-6 linoleic acid to omega-3 linolenic acid for cardiovascular health and strengthening your immune system. It's rich in phytonutrients. Those are what protect your brain and your organs and your bloodstream. It is one of the best-known sources of polyunsaturated fatty acids. And in fact, when hemp is processed into hemp seed oil and hemp seed milk, it further reduces the minute amounts of TCH in hemp. And yet there's a stigma, and there shouldn't be. It's a very important healing seed. Now, pomegranate seeds are phenomenal for you. A half a cup of pomegranate seeds are terrific for repairing the lining of your arteries from a lifetime of alcohol or French fries or pizzas. It can help prevent aging, premature aging. It's a great oxygenator of your blood. and those great antioxidants in hemp help fight the free radicals and also help produce the nutrients that can repair damage to the heart and brain. It helps keep the blood thin and therefore flowing freely, and that helps increase oxygenation of your feet, your legs, your muscles, and your brain. It's very rich in polyphenols, and that helps reduce the risk of heart disease and cancer. In fact, it's very high in tannins, T-A-N-N-I-N-S, anthocyanins, antho, A-N-T-H-O, cy, C-Y, anins, A-N-I-N-S, and ellagic acid, E-L-L-A-I-G, E-L-L-A-G-I-C, ellagic acid. That's what you also get in green tea and red wine. And it's rich in potassium, vitamin C. So on every level, pomegranate is great for you. Flaxseed, of course, is good. Just 1 to 2 teaspoons of ground flaxseed is terrific for fiber, the essential fatty acids, and especially the ALA, once again, the anti-inflammatory ALA, decreases the production of agents that promote inflammation. So if you have inflammation anywhere in your body, arthritis, fibromyalgia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, cancer, you'll want this twice a day. It also helps suppress appetite. Pumpkin seeds, 1/2 cup of pumpkin seeds a day, are very alkalizing. In fact, they are the only alkaline seeds, the alkaline-forming seeds, and that's terrific, especially since our diet is so acidic. All the hot dogs, meats, that's acidic, and that helps alkalize. It also gives you a terrific amount of protein. In fact, 100 grams of pumpkin seeds provide 54% of the daily requirement in terms of protein, and that's not a lot. It's also good in the B-complex, and it has L-tryptophan, which helps boost your mood, allowing you to feel better. It helps prevent kidney stones, and because it helps prevent the formation of calcium oxalate kidney stone material. It's very good and has been used historically as a folk remedy for fighting parasites, especially tapeworms. And don't assume that, you know, somehow you're immune from those. In point of fact, what I used to do is I would ask people who came up in the evening to watch the studies, experiments I was doing at the Institute of Plant Biology, and I would be doing my studies. They'd be on the other side of this glass partition watching and asking questions. And one of them says, well, don't you have to eat raw meat for a long time to get a tapeworm? I said, not at all. I said, you can get different types of worms that can lodge in your intestine, and you'll never know they're there. Yes, you could have gas and bloating and fatigue and anemia, but you still wouldn't know they're there. Not easy to diagnose and misdiagnose more often than not. I said, but let's do this. You go out to the finest sushi restaurant you can find in the neighborhood and bring me back sushi. And they would, one piece, and I would then show them by taking a tiny sliver, putting under a microscope, you could actually see worms. I remember the time that a truck driver, big guy, came up to the Fertile Earth Farm. This was about 1976. And I was doing a workshop over a weekend on organic farming. And I remember that he was watching what was going on, but then I didn't see him at the lunch where we have 2 or 3 big picnic tables, custom made like 16 foot long each, loaded with different types of vegan dishes. And so later in the day, I said, you didn't join us for lunch? I had lunch. I said, what'd you have? He said, well, I had something you probably wouldn't approve of. I said, well, what? And he had this, giant sandwich. But he hadn't eaten all of it. And he had it in a wrapper. And I said, take a look at that ham. Take a look at the beef. That's not thoroughly cooked. Well, it's safe, or they wouldn't, say something wasn't safe. I said, it's not that they intentionally want you to have a worm, but that's what gives you worms. Oh, I don't believe it. That's nonsense. 3 months later, he comes by the studio, and he says, I thought you would like to see this. And he pulls out of this backpack a big mason jar, and in the mason jar is a ball. And at first it looks like a ball of twine. And I look at it, I see these are worms. He said, yep. He said, and you have no idea how I screamed when they took it out of me. Well, he had it diagnosed, and sure enough, he had these worms. And they had to do a very painful opening up the anus. And imagine the size of a baseball coming out of your anus. That is going to be painful. And they were concerned, did they get the heads? Because you lead the heads in, there's a probability it'll grow back. Different types can grow back. So they give them drugs that dislodge everything. So he said he just wanted him to put that in some formaldehyde or alcohol so he could show it to me. And boy, has he learned his lesson. He's no longer eating pork, because you can get it from pork, you can get it from beef, you can get it from turkey, you can get it from chicken, you can get it from fish. So just keep that in mind. You're not going to get it from pumpkin seeds. Now, apricot is also good. It is an important seed, but I don't want people eating it because, yes, it has amygdalin, which comes to us as the form of Laetrile, or called, it's not actually technically vitamin B17, but that's what it's been described at. But there are places in the world, like in Hunza, which borders China and Pakistan, and high up in the Himalayas, that do consume these. It was a Dr. Ernest Krebs, who I had on my radio program, a biochemist, who first produced Laetrile, concentrated amygdalin, in the 1950s. He recommended it for people who wanted to prevent cancer. And I know how powerful they are because I had a long conversation with Dr. Sugiri at Sloan Kettering, who was the first to use it and came up with good results. But it also can be somewhat toxic, so that's one I don't want you to eat. But sesame seeds, a quarter cup a day, yes, because they have extremely good amounts of magnesium, calcium, iron, phosphorus, B1, and fiber. And also they contain two unique substances, sesamin, S-E-S-A-M-I-N, and sesamolin, S-E-S-A-M-O-L-I-N. Now, these are a group of beneficial nutrients that can play a great role in your body chemistry. Also, they have lignans, L-I-G-N-A-N-S, and they've been shown to lower your cholesterol, lower your blood pressure. Very good for you. Cleanse the liver. Sunflower seeds, a quarter of a cup of sunflower seeds are outstanding for fiber, antioxidants, neutralizing free radicals, and helping with your membranes, your brain cells, lowering your cholesterol level. And they are highest in total of what is called phytosterol content. Phyto, P-H-Y-T-O, sterol, S-T-E-R-O-L. And these are compounds in plants that have a structure similar to cholesterol. And when present in the diet in sufficient amounts, are believed to reduce blood levels of cholesterol, enhance your immune system, and help with certain cancers. Also, cumin seeds. 1 tablespoon of cumin seeds a day. These are thousands of years old. They've been used for their health benefits. They're good for digestion. They're good as an antiseptic. They're good for your liver as a cleanse. They can help with a common cold, with sore throat. They're outstanding for turning off pain. Now, when you have them as an oil, they're even more powerful. And watermelon seeds would have to be my number one seed outside of the, well, of course, hemp and chia, but right at the top would also be watermelon seeds. People don't eat them. They should. I try to have a handful of watermelon seeds every day. But if you just had 1 to 2 tablespoons that are rich in flavonoids, linoleic acid, polyphenols, and they're great for you. And then finally, the grape seed. The grape seeds are terrific, and they are the anti-aging seed. Grape juice, grape skin, resveratrol that comes from this, all good, helping you with your anti-aging program. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'll save the other things on cinnamon for another day because I don't want to run out of time to give my special in-depth investigative report, which we're going to do right after these messages. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. In just a few moments, I'm going to share with you a long research project. We had to literally review thousands of studies. It's taken over almost 2 years so I can do this presentation where we simply ask a basic question, are vaccines effective? I've already addressed the issue, are they safe? And we found they're not. But before we go there, I wanted to share just a few insights on tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock Progressive Commentary Hour. The entire hour is devoted to this. But people are rather confused about what's happening in Turkey because over the weekend, the President of the United States made a very emphatic statement that the United States, his administration, no offices had anything to do with the coup against him, Erdogan, the president of Turkey. First off, that's not true. And then we keep trying to say that this religious leader in Pennsylvania really had nothing to do with either. That's not true either. The trouble is it's a very convoluted story where there are no good outcomes and no nice people. But I'll give you a brief overview so at least you know the truth. And mark my words, WikiLeaks and others will be releasing emails proving this. For several dozen years, the CIA, the National Security Agency, the White House, Defense Department has been working inside of Turkey, a very formidable Middle Eastern country, to establish hegemony, but quietly, and doing it without anyone being aware that they were doing it. That meant that they had to infiltrate the military, the banking system, the media, the educational institutions, the police. They had to have their agents in all these positions, and they did. In fact, they control the major media in Turkey. They have over $50 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars in assets, so they're well-funded. They are told not to communicate with each other in ways that could be traceable and to wait. Why? Because they want to make sure that as important as Turkey is in the Middle East, that it no way swings ever towards Russia or Syria, where it once had a good relationship with both, because that would go against our geopolitical and economic interest, since so many pipelines are going through Turkey. And that's why we fortified our military base there. So that's what we were doing. That was our motive for control. But then several things began to happen. One is that there's this part of the bad part of it, that the man who is now in control of Turkey and has been for several years wants to recreate the Ottoman Empire, a new version. To do that, he has to align himself with the most radical of the Sunni sheikhs who also support Wahhabism, the most radical form of Islam, which is similar to what several other countries support, but none as radical as Saudi Arabia. To do that, they also had to get rid of those who support and sponsor more secular, open religious tolerance, such as Syria and Gaddafi. In Gaddafi's Libya, women were equal to men. They had more women educators, more parliamentarians. The highest standard of living for women in all of Africa and the Middle East was in Libya. The highest educational system, the least amount of literacy. By the way, Syria also has had very little literacy. 83% of its population had educations. Now, So they had to undermine this. To do this, they had to go in there and agitate, fake it, make it look like it was an Arab Spring by the population just rising up against Assad. But that wasn't what happened. What happened was, per agent provocateurs, much like in let's say, NATO-aligned countries, Turkey is a NATO country, so it had the backing of NATO. So if anyone attacked Turkey, in effect, all of NATO is required to come to its assistance, including the United States. So here you have a man wanting to return to the brutal, repressive Ottoman Empire. He also wants to restrict religious freedom. And he and his son are kleptocrats. They steal as a right of power. They had as many as 13,000 oil tankers going into Syria, stealing its oil, going into Iraq, stealing its oil, bringing it back into Turkey, and then selling it on the black market for about half of what it was going for in the open market, making millions of dollars every day for ISIS, al-Nusra, and other radical groups, and for itself. We knew that. Did it ever occur to anyone, why didn't the New York Times or any of the major media, CNN, why did they never do an expose and challenge the President and Secretary of State? If you really are against terrorism, why aren't you going after their headquarters? Why aren't you going after their tankers? Why aren't you going after all their money? Well, because then they'd have to go after Turkey and its leadership and Saudi Arabia and its leadership and Qatar and United Arab Emirates and Jordan. All right, and you would have to go after Kuwait, and they're not going to do that. They risk too much. So they simply allowed, on the one hand, terrorists to run amok, getting full funding and weapons from the United States, training from special forces, and then working inside Turkey, and then to get the terrorists to go into into Syria and try to destroy Assad. All that was working great. Until Russia intervened, and what was the first thing Russia did? Blew up all those trucks and then started going after all the targets. Russia did more in 1 month of fighting terrorism in the Middle East than the United States has done in 2 years. Not because we couldn't, but because we didn't want to, because of what it would have done to these alliances and the real motives of us being there. In any case, when it was clear that Syria was not going to fall, Syria was now winning because it had Hezbollah, it had Iran, it had Russia on its side, and Lebanon on its side. Now the head of Turkey decided to have a separate agreement with Russia and then to reestablish diplomatic ties with Assad in Syria. So he went from being the number one provider of terrorist weapons, even hospitals his daughter runs, for the terrorists who are injured to come back into Turkey, all of which the United States and all of its intelligence agency news knew, and that meant that they would then have to get him out of power. Here's what the people don't know. Here's what the media doesn't tell you, because either they don't want you to know this or they don't know it and don't want to know. There was some unusual troop movements in one of the bases in Turkey. The head of their national security, be like the head of our Homeland Security or CIA, saw this and immediately contacted the top military general in Turkey and said, something's wrong, something's happening. They in turn notified others. And finally, they contacted the president and said, you've got to get out. We believe you're going to be killed. And indeed, there was a group of special soldier commandos on their way to a resort where the president and his family were vacationing to kill them all, take over the country. And because they moved quickly, just a moment, just hours, they got out of there or they'd all be dead. And lo and behold, up comes the president, and they took over the television, they took over radio, they took over the newspapers, because they own them. The coup plotters own these. But the one source they didn't have was the internet yet. and one media broadcast. So the president went on and asked his citizens, who, mind you, his citizens are not the best people. These are the radical Islamic believers, right? Real hardline theocrats. And they went to the streets by the hundreds of thousands. They were, many of them were killed. And they're the ones who then stopped the coup, because now there was this crisis. Do we shoot into our own people? How does that look to the world if we're killing unarmed innocents in the streets protesting this coup? So that's when they began to hesitate. And once they hesitated, then the those loyal to the Turkey regime, they started firing back. But it was just and the only reason that the coup did not work, the coup would have worked perfectly had they not been uncovered. But they were, and they had to implement the coup prematurely. And because it was implemented prematurely, not all the people were working together in a cooperative way as they had planned. So then when he survives, he says who was behind it. He was right. But all that was by the CIA, the President of the United States, our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. That's the scandal that's about to come out. They'll try to repress it. The mainstream media won't touch what I just told you. But it'll come out in all the cast of characters. Now, the trouble is on the other end, he is going to go after everyone that's ever been his critic, even though they had nothing to do with any plot or coup. That's why I said there are no good characters here. They're all bad. And so now what you're going to have is you're going to have tens of thousands of people, many of whom are innocent, victimized. Teachers all, by the way, every single dean of every university and college, over 1,500 have been resigned, and they're taking back the media. Now it's being uncovered how widespread, how deep the secret society went. Now, we've all heard from, you know, the Dan Brown's movie, Da Vinci Code, about the Opus Dei. Opus Dei is just a ultra-conservative wing of the of the Catholic belief system. And it's not even a minor player compared to what you're dealing with that took years, decades, and they blew it. Now they've blown it, you're going to have some of the coup plotters testify. And it's all going to unravel. And it's going to lead right back to Hillary Clinton, right back to CIA, right back to all of what we've been doing, including people in the media. That you haven't heard. I'm telling you now, it's going to happen. But more on this tomorrow night. And but first, just to let you know, the Hillary Clinton supporters, who don't question ever anything, including her background, her husband's background, this was a survey taken in California of registered Democrats. I'll only play half of it, 2 minutes long.
Hillary Clinton has announced her vice presidential pick, Karl Marx, her economic advisor, but we still need a few more signatures to support her and her decision.
I'll hand that for you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Hillary has been being advised by Karl Marx for many years now, and choosing him as her vice presidential pick will help boost her candidacy credentials amongst a lot of people. So I appreciate you supporting that.
Not a problem. Have a good day.
Has announced her choice for vice president under her campaign.
Who is it going to be?
Economic advisor Karl Marx. But we still need a few more signatures. Just to ensure that he gets on the ballot with her. Karl Marx has been an Obama advisor for many years now as his economic advisor. So Hillary chose Karl Marx to be the vice presidential candidate. Appreciate you supporting that.
No problem.
See if we can get the utopia we've all been hoping for, finally.
She got to step up. I don't like to see what Trump doing. She got to step up.
Thank you. Right. Your vice presidential pick, communist Karl Marx, but we still, the economic advisor, but we still need a few more signatures to help make sure that...
I live in Arizona.
That this is a nationwide support, print birth date signature to help Hillary's campaign. Karl Marx, her new vice presidential pick. Karl Marx, the economist.
Okay.
I did it backwards. Is that okay?
Now, understand, every one of the people Not one person out of 30 said Karl Marx. Of course, people in this audience would know who Karl Marx was, when he lived, what he stood for. And it tells you about the lack of awareness of a lot of people about the actual political system we live in. Now, we're going to take one more little clip here. I want you to hear about, and I'll only play a part of this. This is about Show Me the Study. Professor Peter McGuire of the National Center for Immunization Research and Surveillance told the Sunrise Program on October 18, 2013, that a vaccinated versus unvaccinated study was in the planning stage. We were promised it 3 years ago. It's not here. I want you to hear this.
Now, I would like to extend the hand of friendship and cooperation to Peter and to the staff at the NCIRS. Work with the AVN. Let's do this study. Let's prove once and for all that fully vaccinated children are healthier and more protected than fully unvaccinated children. I cannot think of one parent in this world who would not vaccinate their child if the information was there to show that their children would be healthier if they were vaccinated. But until that information is there, parents are going to continue to err on the side of caution, especially parents who've already had a child affected by vaccines.
So the study?
Well,
proposed?
This study is still in the planning stage. It's actually more complicated than Merrill suggests. But no, we're keen to see the best quality evidence, and we have no doubt what the outcome will be.
No doubt. Well, that was 3 years ago. You have no study. You've gone no further. Why? If you really believed that vaccines were effective, you'd have done the study to prove all of us wrong who challenge it. You haven't. Show me a single study in all of history where you had one group of 1,000 unvaccinated, another group 1,000 vaccinated cross-matched, and take a look at them year per year for the next 5 years and see who came down with the diseases. You don't have that. You have nothing. And yet, you're the ones in control. The injection deception, deconstructing the science of vaccine efficacy. On July 1st, California's controversial SB 277 bill became law. The measure requires all school-aged children to receive every mandated vaccine or be excluded from public and private classroom settings as well as daycare facilities. Other than homeschooling their kids, parents who object to the full vaccination schedule are left with no options. If millions of children throughout California would be forced by the state to receive over 36 vaccines, we would assume these vaccines' benefits are well established by scientific evidence. Unfortunately, just a cursory glance at the headlines and vaccine efficacy research just this year, just in the last 6 months, simply shows it's not the case. Examples. Fueling doubts about the effectiveness of the mumps vaccine was a 2016 outbreak among students at Harvard University. Incredibly, all of the 40 students who contracted mumps had been fully vaccinated for mumps. The outbreak occurred despite attempts on the part of Harvard health authorities to isolate students who were suffering from the virus. The results of a study released in April of 2016 raised more questions over the effectiveness of the flu vaccine. Researchers at the CDC as well as the University of Michigan published an article in the Journal of Infectious Disease showing that the efficacy of immunization seems to wane even over the course of a single 12 months. The efficacy of the live attenuated flu vaccine was measured at only 38% among healthy adults. The CDC researchers made startling conclusions about the effectiveness of the pertussis vaccine in an article published in 2016 in the journal Emerging Infectious Disease. The study, titled Sustained Transmission of Pertussis in Vaccinated 1 to 5-Year-Old Children in Preschool Florida, examined the efficacy of the whooping cough vaccine in the midst of an outbreak in 2013 in Tallahassee, Florida. The study notes that 50% of all students in one classroom contracted pertussis despite every one of them being fully vaccinated for the disease. As the authors put it, quote, this outbreak raises concerns about vaccine effectiveness in this preschool age group and reinforced the idea that recent pertussis vaccination should not dissuade physicians from diagnosing, testing, and treating persons with compatible illnesses for pertussis, end quote. The CDC Advisory Panel on Immunization Practice recommended that the FluMist nasal influenza vaccine should be taken off the shelves for the 2016-17 season, noting the vaccine's protection rate was a dismal 3%, which means zero protection benefit could be gauged. That means 97% of the people taking it found no benefit at all. So it's no surprise that the passage of SB 277 and similar bills appearing around the country has sparked serious concern among parents. In light of this public outcry, we thought it prudent to review the independent science on the subject of vaccine efficacy. The results of our investigation are sobering. First, let's measure vaccine efficacy. To me, this is junk science at its worst. Every flu season, millions of Americans visit their physician's office or local pharmacy to receive a flu shot. And that same flu vaccine will be injected into a 14-pound infant, a teenage athlete weighing 200 pounds, or frail, immune-compromised elderly patient, regardless of age, weight, medical history, previously compromised immune system, and other serious health factors, the same identical chemical cocktail is administered. We are told to accept this one-size-fits-all approach because it predictably produces a number of protective antibodies that will ward off a flu infection. Once the flu season concludes, vaccinated persons who made it through the season without contracting the virus are categorized as being benefited. They have successfully proven immunization. These statistics then stand as scientific proof of the vaccine's efficacy. Meanwhile, very little attention is given to numerous other factors that have been shown to have a far greater influence on immunity, including the quality of your diet, additional nutrient profile, vitamin A, C, and D, for example, exercise, how often, how much, stress management, exposure to environmental toxins, sleep disturbances, biochemical and genetic dispositions. A person who chooses to be vaccinated and follows a healthy lifestyle by eating a balanced, wholesome diet, minimizing environmental toxins, engaging in regular exercise, and practicing a de-stress technique is far less likely to fall sick. It is therefore impossible to make any scientifically accurate claims that vaccines are the sole protective intervention for warding off infectious disease. On the other hand, an unvaccinated individual who eats a standard American diet suffers from multiple nutrient deficiencies and leads a sedentary, high-stress lifestyle, has a higher risk of developing a significantly compromised immune system condition. If such a person comes down with an illness, how can it be blamed on the absence of a vaccine and not on an unhealthy lifestyle? When assessing the impact of vaccines, removing the body's many other biomolecular principles and functions from the equation is completely scientific fraud. The claim that a vaccine can prevent disease without looking at many other critical health factors in a person's life is contrary to all scientific gold standards for assessing health and illness. It is no different than if a person took vitamin C and subsequently did not come down with a cold. That it was exclusively the vitamin C intake that deserves all the credit also would be completely unfounded and unscientific. This is a very strong element in support of evidence suggesting that all clinical trials carried out by vaccine manufacturers fall way short of demonstrating any efficacy accurately. And when they are shown to be efficacious, it is frequently in the short term and offer only partial protection. According to an article in the peer-reviewed Journal of Infectious Disease, the only way to evaluate vaccines is to scrutinize the epidemiological data obtained from real-life conditions. In other words, researchers simply cannot or will not adequately test a vaccine's effectiveness and immunological consequences prior to its release onto an unsuspecting market. Based upon our research, a study has yet to be undertaken that evaluates the long-term progress of both fully vaccinated and unvaccinated children of comparable biochemistry, ages, and lifestyles. Now, since immunity hinges on more than vaccination status, it simply stands to reason that the only way to make a fair determination about the effectiveness of the current vaccine schedule would be to carry out such an analysis using a gold standard of methodology and protocol that has long been established as accurate. But this has never once been done, not once. To understand this unanswered question, we must look back at vaccinology's history and the scientific evidence that would implicate our national vaccine campaign as a dangerous and deceptive experiment upon the public. And I want to start with the one that they all use. The pro-vaccine people always drag out the polio vaccine. Almost everyone now believes that vaccines were responsible for the eradication of certain major epidemics in the United States and around the world. However, this belief is largely a result of propaganda, not fact. The story of Jonas Salk's polio vaccine is an example of how some vaccines not only fail to save lives, but actually infect the patients with the very disease they're supposed to protect against. The polio vaccine is recognized as the fastest approved drug in FDA history. In 1955, it only took 2 hours. That's it, 2 hours of review before its approval and licensure. And because no significant research could ever have been carried out on the vaccine in such a short span of time, the vaccine was quickly administered on a large scale without proper federal review. Here's what you've never been told. Within days, the first polio vaccination, 40,000 children became infected with polio, 200 with severe paralysis and 10 deaths. This medical disaster was covered up. That would be called the Cutter incident, C-U-T-T-E-R, after the vaccine's manufacturer, Cutter Laboratories. Shortly thereafter, very quietly, the vaccine was withdrawn from circulation and abandoned. It had caused 40,000 American children to develop polio. The CDC's website states the Salk vaccine was a miracle in public health policy. It was not. A critical examination of the facts, however, reveal a very different story. In point of fact, officials at the National Institutes of Health were convinced that the vaccine was contributing to the rise in polio and paralysis cases in the 1950s. In 1957, Edward McBean documented in his book, The Poison Needle, that government officials stated the vaccine was, quote, worthless as a preventative and dangerous to take. Some U.S. states, such as Idaho, where several people died after receiving the Salk vaccine, wanted to hold the vaccine makers legally liable. Dr. Salk himself testified in 1976 that his live vaccine virus, which continued to be distributed in the United States until 2000, was, quote, listen carefully, this is official government record, under oath, the principal, if not sole cause of all polio cases in the United States since 1961. Let me repeat this. The Dr. Salk, who I spoke to, by the way, said the principal, if not sole cause of all polio cases in the United States since 1961 was his vaccine. However, after much lobbying and political leveraging, the pharmaceutical industry pressured the U.S. Public Health Service to proclaim the vaccine safe. 60 years later, the pharmaceutical industry continues to heavily influence public health policy through an army of lobbyists working directly with policymakers. Today, U.S. health authorities proudly claim the U.S. is polio-free and hold up the polio vaccine as an example of a vaccine that eradicated a virus and proof of the unfounded, quote, herd immunity theory. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, a board-certified nephrologist, who has spent more than 10,000 hours researching the safety and efficacy of vaccines, has documented thoroughly that polio's disappearance was actually a game of smoke and mirrors. In her research, she has shown that the alleged disappearance of polio coincided with the rise of new and strikingly similar ailments, which have been classified at variations of a commonly known acute flaccid paralysis. Now, thanks to Dr. Humphrey and Janine Roberts' detailed study of the data, it's not difficult to connect the dots and see that the reported decline in cases of polio over the years has more to do with calling the disease by a different name than eradicating it. Another layer of treachery in the history of the polio vaccine is the story of Dr. Maurice Hilleman, a pioneer in the field of vaccine research at pharmaceutical giant Merck in the 1950s. Dr. Hilleman developed over 40 vaccines, including 5 of the 14 immunizations routinely given to children and adults today. He is considered the father of American vaccinology. In a candid interview, I believe the last filmed interview before he died, Dr. Hilleman explained that monkey DNA was used in some of the vaccines he developed, and it was impossible to screen out all the viruses carried by the monkeys. He discovered that the new Sabin polio vaccine contained simian virus 40, SV40, a DNA virus shown to be carcinogenic. Further, during vaccine trials in hamsters, SV40 was shown to cause tumors. Hilleman said, quote, "We knew it was in our seed stock for making vaccines. It was good science, and at the time, because that was what you did. You didn't worry about these wild viruses," end quote. The precise number of Americans exposed to his contaminated virus with the SV40 and known carcinogen is not known, but we estimate it to be over 100 million Americans. As of 2001, Neil Miller, vaccine research journalist, counted 62 separate peer-reviewed studies confirming the presence of SV40 in a variety of human tissue and different carcinogens. What has contributed historically to the decline of scourges like smallpox, polio, tetanus, measles, and diphtheria? Although many attribute the decrease in incidence of these diseases to the introduction of vaccines, a look at the epidemiology data indicate that many, if not most, infectious diseases started declining long before there was ever a vaccine. And so what we're looking at is an objective understanding of the public health data that shows that better sanitation, proper sewage removal, cleaner water, pasteurization of milk, improved nutrition, indoor plumbing, and the elimination of child labor, less crowded living conditions, better hygiene, washing your hands with soap and water, all of these made a difference. I'll give you an example. Polio declined in the United States in the 1920s from 7,229 cases to 1921, 3,800 cases, and then it had gone down into about 3,000 by 1951. By the time the vaccine became widespread in 1971, the total number of total cases of polio was 1,076. There is no scientifically sound evidence that mass inoculation can be credited with eliminating any infectious disease. Furthermore, if vaccination is responsible for the disappearance of these diseases in the United States, why did they simultaneously disappear in Europe prior to them having any mass vaccination programs? Now, we have compared graphs, actual public health graphs. Give you an example of what they show. From 1900 to 1963, when the measles vaccine was introduced, death rates from measles had declined from 13 per 100,000 to 0.2 per 100,000. That's 98% decrease prior to the vaccine being used. In 1900 to 1949, death rates from whooping cough declined from 12 per 100,000 to 0.5, 0.5%. That's a 96% decrease before any vaccine was introduced. From 1900 to 1949, death rates from diphtheria declined from 40.3 per 100,000 to 0.4. That's 99% decrease before any vaccine. So the vaccine graphs are clear. They show that the vaccines did not impact any of those conditions, and yet the vaccine is given 100% credit when it does not deserve it. So the data shows clearly and unequivocally and objectively that improved hygiene and all the other things I mentioned earlier, that is what made the difference, not the vaccine. So what I'm going to do is tomorrow, I'm going to deconstruct the science of antibodies. Because I know many people claim, well, you know, the vaccine gives you antibodies. Yes, it can. Now show me the proof that that vaccine's antibody stimulation is protective, because I'll show you people with a lot of antibodies after vaccine who come down with the disease. I'll show you people with no antibodies who don't get the disease when exposed. Why? You have to understand the science of our immunology. Understand the antigen-specific cytotoxic T lymphocytes and all the others that go into it, natural killer cells, macrophages, and I will give you that inside look on part two of a very important special original investigative report that is now posted, and you can go to your my website and get it. It's called The Injection Deception, Deconstructing the Science of Vaccine Efficacy. And every person that is now questioning whether or not to vaccinate should read this before making their decision. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Time again, this time I'm gonna win.